Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Winblad, co-founder and managing director of Hummer Winblad Venture Partners, and your moderator for today's program. It is now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, William Draper, venture capitalist, entrepreneur, and author of the new book, The Startup Game. Hundreds of companies from Activision to Skype have found their start and success with Bill Draper. Bill is one of the patriarchs of the venture capital industry. He began his venture career over 50 years ago when in 1959 he left his job as a steel salesman in Chicago to work as an associate in his father's newly formed venture firm, Draper, Gaither & Anderson, the first venture capital firm on the West Coast. In 1962, Bill formed his own firm, Draper & Johnson Investment Company, with his good friend and steel industry co-worker, Pitts Johnson. In 1965, Bill co-founded Sutter Hill Ventures, which remains today one of the leading venture capital firms. During a 12-year sabbatical from Silicon Valley, Bill served as the chairman of the Export-Import Bank of the United States and head of the United Nations Development Program. Bill returned to the Valley from Washington in 1994 and with Robin Richards founded Draper Richards International and subsequently the Draper Investment Company and the Draper Richards Foundation. Bill is the beloved husband of his wife of 57 years, Phyllis, the proud father of two daughters, Polly and Becky, and his son, Tim, the renowned founder of the third generation Draper venture dynasty, Draper Fisher Jurvetson. And there appear to be plenty of grandchildren as candidates for the fourth generation. Bill has received numerous awards for his business success and civic commitments. Bill is not only a remarkable person, but is known to all as a true gentleman. Please welcome Bill Draper. Bill, first let me congratulate you on a terrific book. And I also want to wish you a happy birthday, as I understand your 83rd birthday was January 1st.
Yeah, I'm still a young man. That's why I'm staying in the business. You got to be optimistic. And if I were getting into my older years, I'd probably get more pessimistic. But I'm feeling very optimistic.
Let's start tonight by talking about your father. Your father was a career banker and diplomat. Then at age 65, he moves to Silicon Valley to start the first venture capital firm on the West Coast. Tell us about your father and how this career change came about for him.
Well, he, like me, I think, never liked to see his learning curve flatten out. So he did quite a variety of things. And he always had public service as one of his goals in life. He was an investment banker in the early days. He came, went to NYU in New York, and very humble beginnings, actually, the son of a dentist. He became a partner of Dillon Reed, which was like the Morgan Stanley. Morgan Stanley and Dillon Reed were the top two firms in New York at that time in the 30s. And then he left there and went into kind of saw the war coming. He was he kept his reserve commission, which he had gotten earlier, and eventually became a major general in the Army and undersecretary of war when there was no Defense Department. So the Air Corps was under that wing. He went on to start the first venture capital firm in the West. There was J.H. Whitney in New York, and there was American Research and Development, General Doreo from Harvard Business School fame, started that before Draper Fisher draper Gaythorne Anderson started. And so it was known as a term, venture capital, back in those days, but not out in the West. It was brand new. My wife described it as to her friends, well, I think he does some private banking, and that was essentially the way she described it. But it was not a known term out here. There were really only a couple in the East.
So your dad comes out here. You, meanwhile, finish your degree at Yale, serve in Korea, and then graduate from Harvard. You're in a prestigious management program in sales at Inland Steel in Chicago. So you've got your entire career in front of you. But you decide to leave Chicago and join your father's firm, Draper, Gaither, and Anderson. Now, we know what your wife is telling other people what you're going to do. What did you tell your young family about this new career move for you?
Well, I take you back. In the book, I talk about going to see the former chairman of Inland Steel, who still had the biggest office in the Inland Steel building in the center of the loop. You can't even see it now, but it was the Owens Corning design, and it was a spectacular building in those days. And Clarence Randall leaned across the desk and said, I wouldn't do it if I were you. It sounds very risky. And he said, I knew somebody that went into the investment business, lived in Highland Park. They had to move. He lost everything. And they had to move and leave town. It was very embarrassing. I think you better stay right here. And I'm this young guy, you know, behind this desk. I've never seen such a big desk. And I am saying, oh, well, I know, but my father is going to be in there, and I'm kind of excited about going to San Francisco, which was a dream place as far as I was concerned. It was exciting. And so I think it wasn't hard to leave, but it was hard to get out of that office and say, I'm sorry, but I'm really leaving.
So now you're in the game. You're in the startup game. What was venture capital like in the early 60s?
So Pitch Johnson, and well, start Draper, Gaither, and Anderson. There were five young guys like myself. We didn't know anything about venture capital either. Don Lucas was one of them, and he had been on Wall Street knew something about it, but really it was all of us were new. He was 29 years old, I was 31, that kind of thing. And we kind of all learned together. Fred Anderson was the was my father's partner, and he had been head of the 8th Bomber Command, and Averell Harriman suggested he be my dad's deputy when he was in Paris running the Marshall Plan, because Anderson was more of a risk taker, more they, 12 o'clock high was written about. I mean, he was Clark Gable in that. So when you see that, think of General Anderson. He was a great guy. And he came out here. He had been out here in the California as Trevor Air Force Base. And he knew California, so he came back, and he got started doing a few, we called them special situations in those days. and he actually identified Paul Cook, who started Raychem, and invested in Raychem. And so the two of them were together, and they needed a good, solid head, like, and somebody who was rooted here in San Francisco, and that was Round Gaither. So it was Draper, Gaither, and Anderson. It's a wonderful group of men and five young guys. It only lasted 7 years, and I think today it would be one of the finest venture firms in the country, but for the fact that very soon after we started Draper, Gaither, and Anderson, Round Gaither died. I of cancer, and he was a very very important cog in it. And when he was gone, then my father went back to Washington because his heart was always in Washington. He did a lot of things there and started the Population Crisis Committee, which now Population Action International, and still going. And he just had a variety of careers, really, that anybody would have been proud of, and I was very proud to be his son.
So now your dad returns to Washington. You're on your own. It's around 1962. The Beatles released their first single, Love Me Do. The Vietnam War is escalating. President Kennedy says we'll have a man on the moon. And you have to go out and find a new partner to start your own firm. And you convince your Inland Steel buddy, Pitch Johnson, to join you.
That's right.
What did you tell Pitch about this new career that was ahead of him in venture capital?
To be honest, I think the only thing I had to tell him was that I was going to have this company in Palo Alto. Pitch was from Palo Alto, and I met him in this grimy town, East Chicago, Indiana, where the Inland Steel factory was, but also there was a cement plant and a oil refinery, and they all dumped their ashes on our cars. So we'd wash them on Saturday, and we'd wash them on Sunday. And then it was a great way to begin, because our wives never complained after leaving there. It was one of the great ways to start a family. And we both built up, we each had a few kids. In fact, I had one born in Indiana, one born in Illinois. And he had a couple born. When I had the second girl, he said, "Oh, gosh, I'm so sorry, Bill." I said, "Hey, what do you mean?" He said, so Pitch and I have been best friends ever since. And when I told him it was Palo Alto, see, he went to Pali High. He went to Stanford. And when he was out in East Chicago, Indiana, the days get a little long compared to what he knew. I was brand new out here. I didn't know anything. And a lot of our partners and friends were introduced to us by Pitch. So it was a great relationship and has continued to this day.
So now you're in business, and you know, you're a venture capitalist. You have to create deal flow. How'd you go out and find some entrepreneurs to fund in 1962?
So this is the way it worked. Draper Gaither and Anderson was right across the street. We were on the Stanford campus on Welch Road. I didn't like the name because I always thought, you know, you shake hands and you got a deal. You don't want to Welch on that deal, and we live on Welch Road. But I did when Pitch and I started. We, Roy Demon and his partners built a kind of a cheap building on the other side of the street. Draper, Gaither, and Anderson had a kind of a fancy one, and we had the Rockefellers as limited partners, and Luzard Fair, and so on. So it was kind of got 3-page article in Business Week when it first was announced. So the deal flow over across the street at Draper, Gaither, and Anderson was pretty good. But we decided that we would lease. We couldn't buy them. We really, neither of us had much money. We borrowed most of the money we started. And we only started with $75,000 each. 25 we had, and we borrowed 50 each. And then leveraged it with an SBIC, a small business investment company, where they give you, the government gives you 3x. So we decided we better rent 2 Pontiacs. They were both blue. And we went out. I went to Yale. He went to Stanford. But somehow I got the arrangement to make them blue. And we went out to orchards, fruit orchards, and looked around for a building that had something other than prune or a prune warehouse, you know, on the sign. And we'd knock on the door and say, "Hi, you know, is the president in?" And he'd come out. He'd be about our age, typically. And we say, "Well, you know, we thought we're in the venture capital business." He said, "What? What is venture capital?" And then we tell him, and then he, "And what do you do?" And so then he said, "Well, come into my office." And the And we'd waste morning after morning going around their time and our time. But pretty soon we became the go-to guys in Silicon Valley from these bankers that were in the city. Because San Francisco was a banking town and not much more. And you could see the Seven Hills. Can't see them now. But it was exciting to all of a sudden have a function that people recognized, and so they call us when they get a call from some little company down there that they needed more investment money or whatever, or banking. So that became the way we got our business.
So you got to use all that training as a salesman.
Yeah, that's right. I was a salesman. He teases me about that because he said, "You really, it's embarrassing for you to say that you were a steel maker because really you just sold steel. I made the steel. I was in the open hearth," and he was. And he went on, when the guys would go on strike, the blue collar workers would go on strike, then the white collar workers had to go in and make the plant work. And he did that for 9 days, 10 days. And they all made a deal. The white collar give everybody blue collar 9% raise. And then we all, white collar workers, all got the same 9%. So as a result, we just kept, union kept striking, our salaries kept going up, and the price of steel kept going up. And pretty soon there isn't a pound of steel being made in East Chicago today. Because the foreign steels have put us out of business, and those tariffs and unions have really killed the business.
So in the startup game, you have to make your first deal with your name on it. So you and Pitch ultimately have to write a check. We all remember our first deal quite well. What was your first deal?
Mine was when I was at Draper Gaither and Anderson. I went down, Reed Dennis was at Fireman's Fund, and he called me. He's now, well-known venture capitalist. And Reed called me and said, look at this deal down the street from you. It's called Corbin Farnsworth. And so I like to go down. I like to get on the ground. I don't do it too much anymore, which is lazy, and I don't do as well. But if you get in the office of the plant of the entrepreneur, he's more relaxed, or she is more relaxed. In those days, it was he is more relaxed. And so I went down and talked to Elliot Farnsworth, and I said, "Well, what is a defibrillator?" And he said, "Well, Bill, lie down." And he had this table. So I lie down on the table, and he comes out with this huge defibrillator, the first defibrillator in the world. And it was about that big. The paddle was that big. And I said, "I don't know that you should. Maybe just tell me more about it." And sure enough, we invested. I got General Anderson to come down and look at it. He liked it, liked the guys. And we made a lot of money on it. We sold it to Smith, Kline, and French. It's still going. It's up in Seattle, but it's still, saved a lot of lives. So that was my first deal. I'm very proud.
And what do you remember about that entrepreneur?
I'm also glad he didn't turn on the electricity.
What do you remember about that entrepreneur? Why fund that guy?
Elliot knew his business. He was a techie guy, and he was sensible. He had done his research. He knew the market he was going after, and it was brand new, and it was very exciting. It's like, you see the first laser, and you don't know what it's going to do, but it's got all this focused light, coherent light. And I saw Tom Perkins took me over to see the first laser ever, I think. And he didn't know what they were going to do with it and how it was going to sell or what the use would be. And think of all the uses, whether it's medical or military today. So you kind of go with if it's really exciting, really brand new. And there are a lot of startups today that are not really exciting, not really brand new, that are kind of on the edge of another good idea. I mean, if somebody comes in and says, "I've got the next Facebook," you go, "Oh, yeah, maybe."
So one more time, you're on your own. because Pitch decides he wants to go back and work at a company.
Yeah.
So you then co-found Sutter Hill Ventures.
Yeah, the way that happened was there was a company called Sutter Hill, and it was Sutter's Mine and the Hills of San Francisco. Frank Lodato named it. And Frank and his brother-in-law, Greg Peterson, both great guys, were in the real estate business. They were in made shopping centers. But they got an SBIC license and hired a guy named Paul Wise and wanted to go into the venture capital. Well, since we had done a lot of deals by that time, we had done a lot of deals. They had a lot of money. And we thought this is a very good combination. So Pitch and I agreed to merge with them, and Pitch went his way, and later went back into the venture world. But and he and I have done many, many deals together now. Paul and I started Sutter Hill and as a venture firm, a separate partnership. And that's an interesting story. We went down to... I knew a guy who was with Société Générale de Belgique, and they said, this friend of mine said, you know, if you ever want any money, we are interested in getting into technology. And this was, the time came when we were short on money, and we went to see, I called him, and I met Max Nocan, who was chairman of the board of Société Générale de Belgique, then on the board of SRI, and we met at a dinner of SRI, and he said, well, you got to go to Canada because that's where Genstar is, and that's where we do all our North American deals. So I went to this company that owned housing development, inland construction, and Inland Cement, and even though no connection to my Inland Steel, they owned a lot of variety. They owned tugboat operations on both coasts, everything in Canada, nothing in the U.S. So we brought the president out to see, after I went to Place-Ville-Marie in Quebec to meet with him, brought the president out here and took him around to see our deals. Well, one deal we took him to was down in L.A. Paul and I took him in. This guy was going to put Xerox out of business. And he had a really smooth, sexy-looking machine. And the entrepreneur said, I think he was British, actually, said, well, Angus, put in a dollar, give me a dollar bill. Angus insists to this day, because he loved California. He moved the headquarters of Genstar here, believe it or not, because he loved it so much. But he says to this day that it was not a dollar, but it was a $100 bill. Anyway, it goes in there. We're going to copy the $100 bill. Okay, and this entrepreneur turns the switch on. It's all in fire. The whole thing's on fire, the whole machine. I mean, it isn't just the $100 bill that's crisp. It's the whole machine. We had to get the fire extinguisher, and the fireman came. Oh, my God. Well, no, the place didn't burn down, but that machine did. And you know the interesting thing in those days, Anne, you had a disaster on your hands as far as the product and the service and so on, but you had a good team. And there were lots of people, lots of big companies that wanted to learn what technology was going on in this silicon area, the new chips and all that. They wanted to know. So they'd hire the team. We got all our money out of Duplicon, even though we straight up told them, you know, the machine doesn't work.
That's why we fund software companies. Nothing ever catches on fire.
Yeah. That's right.
So, Bill, much of the public dialogue about venture capital focuses on the deal, valuations. There's been a lot of press about valuations. We'll talk about that later because we have questions from our audience today. But your book is very much about the relationship of the venture capitalist and the entrepreneur. You've described your philosophy of working with entrepreneurs as investing based on trust, the handshake, not the term sheet. How do you and the entrepreneur get to this point of trust?
It all starts with your first deal. And you build a reputation gradually, and eventually you have a reputation that you want to uphold and that other people admire and want to be a part of. And so I think the whole thing starts with your very first deal. The entrepreneur has his first board meeting, and typically people call it the oh shit meeting, because the venture capitalist finds out the bad news at the board meeting that he didn't know when he made the investment. And so how that venture capitalist reacts to that bad news is part of that relationship. And it'll either get more brittle or more or closer and more bonding as time goes on. And very often, you know, more often than I'd like to admit, we have to close a company down. And we've got to make sure that the employees are all taken care of, the rent is paid, that everything is up to date. And a lot of times that means putting in more money when you know the thing is dead on arrival. So the entrepreneur and the venture capitalists, assuming they're the kinds of people that I like to deal with, get to be more and more bonding, closer, and more supportive of each other. So that's the way it happens.
So you say in the book that you tell entrepreneurs, work hard, keep your antenna up, and have sound judgment without a big ego. There seem to be plenty of big egos in Silicon Valley. Do you need courage or some sort of ego to be successful in this very competitive world?
Sure. I think it's no doubt about it. There are all kinds of venture capitalists, and there are all kinds of entrepreneurs that become successful. I just think that the venture capitalists, at least, who are less about themselves and more about building a great company, supporting the entrepreneur, seeing that the entrepreneur gets the full credit. I don't know if any of you saw Harbaugh. I bet all of you did. Saw Harbaugh on television being interviewed right after winning the Rose Bowl, the Orange Bowl. Did you notice that he would not talk about himself? He said the whole credit goes to the team and the job they did, and he just was asked several times, given several opportunities to talk. Now, he's got a big ego, but he knows how to play it, control it, and I think that's kind of basic. Yeah, you're right. Right, and a few names come to your mind and mine who have egos that fill this room and beyond. And
but we won't name them.
We won't name them, no.
So we're making the startup game sound kind of easy, but it's really risky. Investing in startups, our early stage investments, means risk all up front. Investing in new areas, and most of the time, first-time entrepreneurs. The question that's frequently asked is, how important are the people versus how important is the market opportunity?
Okay. You get two different answers. You ask Don Valentine, who's one of the most successful venture capitalists in the Valley. By the way, it shouldn't be called Silicon Valley anymore. I think it should be called Vision Valley or something that is, there's no, you know, Silicon is, that stuff is done in Taiwan. We don't do that. We do your software. But
let's call it Software Valley. I'm for that.
Yeah. But anyway, you have all this action, and I don't know why we're talking about it, because it takes both. It takes a market that's big enough and growing, and it takes a leader who's strong and focused, and a team that has been selected by her. and him or him. And there's a lot of, there's a balance. But once in a while, it's a great leader who just gets over every hurdle and builds that market or makes the product work when it didn't at first. And sometimes the market, like in Skype's case, we had two very creative entrepreneurs. And the two of them worked so well together. One was Danish and one was Swedish. And they had a great way of working. One, mostly the technology, the other, mostly the business side. Zennstrom was the business side. But man, that market was there to just be picked. And this internet, what is it?
Voice over IP.
Pointer, yeah. Thank you. The main thing is that voice over IP was coming. It was ready. There were a lot of other people that were trying to do it, but the two of them had some secret sauce that made that voice sound clearer than a wired voice. And as a result, I think the market just exploded for them. Everybody wanted it when it really worked, and it was so easy. And now, you know, we have a registered nurse that lives with us, and her 8-year-old son, born in the United States, he's a U.S. citizen, but she has she's from the Philippines, and she talks to her mother every day, who's got a liver problem, and that little boy makes such a difference in his grandmother's life. And you know, that's the heart of the thing. There's the business side. You can now have your board meeting and you can see the person that's also on the board, but he's in Sweden. And that's kind of, the market was there. The product was perfection. And they'll have an IPO, I think, very soon. I think next year, because we sold it once, you know, to eBay. And now the two partners wanted to keep their share, and they're going to sell it again in the IPO, and it'll be a good buy.
So you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is legendary venture capitalist William Draper, who's sharing his secrets of success in both business and life from his new book, The Startup Game. Let's talk about another one of these risky investments. You've said that good venture capitalists need to be humble. They need to really understand people. They need to be inquisitive, generous with their time, and open to good ideas from new and unexpected directions. So how did you come upon Zappos, a pretty new idea selling shoes online, especially in 1999? How did you know it wasn't just one of those crazy internet ideas?
You, Anne, I knew you were going to give me a zinger. In the book, this is one of my examples of what not to do. Yes, the best thing was that we invested in Zappos at the startup. And we did that because we had had good luck with the same entrepreneur prior to that in another company called Link Exchange. And Robin Richards and I should mention Robin, she and I started the India Fund, but we also made local domestic deals too. And this was one of them. We at one of these shows in LA, electronic shows, Link Exchange had a big truck outside with Link Exchange. And there was no advertising. They had a very low budget. And we thought, these guys are creative. Anyway, we invested in that. It did very well. And Sequoia was with us, too. So we backed Tony Hsieh when he wanted to start Zappos. Well, Zappos was not a name we thought anything about, except he wanted to sell shoes over the internet. We thought that's a good idea. And so we were in there for a good long time. Then the bubble burst, right? Remember that? And there's a very scary time. Robin and I had been quite lucky. We had sold off a lot of our investments as that bubble was rising, and right at the peak in some cases. So we were feeling probably a little less humble than we should have, because we held Zappos stock, a convertible debenture. And in talking with Tony, he said, you know, you're the 2 years, it was kind of a 2-year debenture, I think, at that, is up, and you want to convert it or you want to get your money back. So I said, you know, given all things being equal, I think we'll take our money back. That's why I'm mad at you bringing that one up, Ben. Because Zappos was sold for $1 billion to Amazon, and it's doing huge revenue. And if I had only talked to my friend Jim Ludwig, who I slaughtered in tennis Sunday, if I had talked to him, he ran Saks Fifth Avenue, and he would have known, I think, that we shouldn't sell Zappos at that point, but we did. So that's one of my exits. Don't exit too soon in chapters. You know, I tell you a lot about mistakes that I made. And if any venture capitalist looks you in the eye and says he hadn't made more mistakes than he's made good decisions, I think he's lying. It's very easy to, I would never get a friend or a neighbor to put money into any one deal that I backed, because the odds are kind of against it making it. But as a, you know, if you do 20 of them, you may have a Zappos, or you may have a Facebook, or you may just have a nice 5 or 10 times your money.
So you talk about patience and the need to swim against the tide, and you felt with Zappos that you had neither.
Yeah.
So let's fast forward to OpenTable. Here's another company that you were the first investor in.
Yep.
It took 10 years to achieve a successful IPO. Today it has a fantastic market cap of, yep, $1.8 billion. Were there times along the way where either the entrepreneurs or the investors thought about getting out, were losing their patience, weren't willing to wait 10 years?
Thomas Layton was running the company. He's a friend of Robin's. And I used to meet with Thomas, and he and I would always, I would say, you know, on the strategy, you have everybody eating out of the palm of your hand. Most of you know that this is the system that where you can order your table and reservations at restaurants with over the internet. And every time you do, OpenTable gets a dollar for every one of the reservations, every one of the people in the reservation. I said, you know, everybody loves you. My wife and I eat at all these fancy restaurants, and they all love it. They love it. I ask every one of them, what do you think of OpenTable? Oh, we couldn't live without it. Why don't you charge $2 for everybody? And no, Bill, you don't get it. We want to own the market. And then I said, okay, but why are you leasing these machines? Because they're not computers that the restaurant owns. These are machines that are manufactured and delivered to the restaurant and leased to the restaurant, and the payout is over a 14-month period, or 16 months, something like that. Well, why don't you, I mean, let's not make this company capital intensive. Let's just charge them cash for these. Bill, you don't get it. You got to understand, we want to own the market. Well, I'm so glad he didn't take any of my advice. He just did beautifully without it, and had good reasons not to change his way of operating until the point we're now, you know, in just about every state, and we're in London and going for the world.
So when you meet an entrepreneur today and you're making that first investment, and he or she says, I want to build a great company, do you tell them it will likely take 10 years?
We tell them that it will. We very often tell them that they have underestimated the timeline, and they say, "Well, no, we've really thought it through, and we've doubled the time we think it really take." And we look at it, and we double the time that they said, and that's very often not enough. So it's easy to tell them that it's going to be a 10-year project and you want to build a great company, so you want to go brick by brick and not make it a quick buck turn. When the investment banking community from Wall Street realized we were making a lot of money in the venture world out here in the first, you know, in the early days, And in fact, John Weinberg from Goldman Sachs came into my office. I had a little office down there in Palo Alto, and we had been in the business for maybe 6 or 8 years. We were making 30%, 40% per year return. When he came into my office, I didn't realize that was a big return actually, until he came into my office, and I thought, here's the CEO of Goldman Sachs coming in to see our little operation. We must be on to something. And so today you don't get those returns in the venture community because Wall Street has dumped a lot of money out here and they've made the business far more competitive than it ever was before. But that's good for the country. And it's great for the entrepreneurs because they can go around. When I say no, and I, you know, go to my old formula, well, we put up all the money, you put up all the blood, sweat, and tears, you get half the company, we get half the company, right? That doesn't go very well. And when there's the competition that there is today, chasing a good opportunity, it would work fine for a really sloppy, weak deal, but you don't want that one. That's not what we're going after. We're trying to build a great company. Anyway, life is a little different than it was, but I'm still a young man, and therefore very optimistic about the future. And I'm expecting my next 83 years to see a lot of action. But I think the world is much better off for the fact that Wall Street has come to Silicon Valley and to other places and poured money in, because the deal that might not have gotten done gets done, and it might be the big game changer for all of us, and we can carry, we'll have chips on our, probably sewed into our body, that will tell us everything we want to know. But I'm sort of glad I probably won't live quite that long. But
so, Bill, you've described a company as having three stages: the trial and error phase, followed by reality phase, and then the rev it up or close it down phase.
Yeah.
Seems like a pretty straightforward recipe for company building. Why do many companies fail?
The entrepreneurs have underestimated the time it takes, as we were saying. They've underestimated the difficulty of getting to the customer. They've underestimated, or they've overestimated, the number of customers that they will have, and they very often, if they're engineers, and they very typically are, if you're in the technology side of venture capital, they're very often, pretty geeky in a lot of ways. And some of them are really geeky good, like Bill Gates, for instance. Geeky good Gates. But There's a lot that goes into building a company, and the engineer very often underestimates the marketing effort. So they hire sort of a second-rate marketing guy or vice president of sales or something. So those are some of the reasons. Other reasons are problems within the company. We've had companies that where two of the founders have problems, and we've actually put them with therapists who will help them figure out what's going on in the other person's mind and try to live with it and work with it. It's fun, but it's scary and difficult to build a company. There's a guy named Dave Boston that built MeasureX up till we went on the public on the New York Stock Exchange years ago. He had run a division of a big company, and when he came out to the West Coast, he was looking for technology because he wanted to go digital with this equipment that measures the thickness and moisture content of paper in these big paper machines. And so this equipment that he made sold for $250,000, which is a big number in those days. And he came as an experienced, he's an MIT graduate, so he had that management experience, and I felt totally comfortable with him. On the board, I love those board meetings because he knew how to handle us, the board. And he guided us, and mostly we applauded and learned a lot and didn't really do an awful lot to help him build a great company because he knew what he was doing. We had board meetings. It was a lot of fun because it was an international company. So we had one board meeting in Tokyo, we declared a dividend in Russia. That was he loves that because here's a real capitalist tool, dividends. But anyway, that was MeasureX, and that was an easy job, and we just watched our. You know, you go to sleep at night. If you pick good management and they've got good product and the market is growing, you go to sleep and the money is still rolling in. That's the kind of deal you always want but seldom get.
So, Bill, you leave Silicon Valley for a decade and go to Washington. And so a decade passes and it's 1993 and you're back in Silicon Valley. You help create the venture capital industry. And you come back and you decide to do something different, to form Draper Richards International. During your absence, you visited 101 countries. And upon returning, you decide you're going to put your money outside Silicon Valley. It's a real bustling time in the Valley, lots going on, lots of good deals. What shaped your decision to pick an emerging country, and how did you decide on India?
And that was the easiest decision I ever made because I had seen the world. I've been running the United Nations Development Program, which is a large aid coordinating operation. I was the second ranking person in the UN at the time, and I did that for 7 years, so I really got to know the world. If you want to know where Burkina Faso is, I can tell you. But the point is, when I came back, I wanted to make sure that I didn't just go home again, in quotes, and flatten out on my learning curve and so on. So I wanted to, and I thought, why not have some venture capital abroad go? And I wanted, I thought Asia is the country, is the region that is growing fastest. And so I found Robin Richards, my great good fortune, introduced by a good friend, Bill McClashen. And we didn't know where in Asia we were going. We checked out China, Vietnam, and there's a Vietnamese princess right here. She's walking right there. She is, and wave to your fans. So we looked at Vietnam. We looked at Indonesia, and decided on India because they spoke English, they knew something about software business, computer software, because of the English. They got a jump on that. There were some very successful Indians here in the Valley, and so our choice was easy, and the food we liked better than the Chinese food. So
Bill, was that fund was really successful? If I recall from the book, it was a 16x return.
Yeah.
Was the startup game
in 6 years?
Was the startup game different in India than what you had learned in Silicon Valley?
No, we had a couple of very good Indians in India. One in Bangalore, one in now Mumbai. But the game is pretty much the same all over the world. You find good people. There was a man named Murthy who ran a company called Infosys, which I had never heard of when I first met him. And I went, and he, to me, is the Dave Packard of India. When Robin and I first sat in his office, he called in the a man who was washing the dishes in back of his office, and he was an old guy who came and I think was a little nervous, and Murthy held up the glass, and he said, "Now you look at this glass, and there's not a speck on it, and that's because of what this man is doing," and he told us that what he wanted was everybody in that organization to feel that his job was really significant and going to make a difference in the success of the company. And he initiated having everybody have some stock, some options, and something like that. Infosys, of course, took off. That was long before it went public. And the joke is we made 16 times on our investment, worked hard as heck over those 6 years to make it work that way. And we might have invested in Infosys and done better than that after it went public on the New York, on the over-the-counter. So there is the Dave Packard of India, and he's still a dear friend of mine, but we never got any piece of the action.
So Silicon Valley has always been a mecca for global entrepreneurs who came here to start their companies and stayed. With the globalization of the entrepreneur, is Silicon Valley still unique?
I think it really is. And my son, Tim, who's the bookend on the, you know, my father on one end, or I'm the ham in the sandwich. I don't know how you do it. But anyway, he is Fisher Jervison, started that out on his own. I went to Washington and really didn't give him any training or anything. Each of the three of us started our own companies. It's interesting, as opposed to building on each other. We did build on each other. We jumped on our shoulders of our parents. But man, I never would dream that Tim could have, with his partners, wonderful partners, John Fisher and Steve Jervison, and all the other partners they've got now, how they could have gotten a global organization together that works, where the local partners are in control of the deal making, but they get backed up by the mother church back in Palo Alto on Sand Hill Road. So I think it's going a whole new dimension, and I think Silicon Valley will be more powerful in the future, but in relation to other parts of the economic world, Silicon Valley probably be less significant than it is today, because there'll be a Silicon Valley in Russia, in Moscow, and there'll be one in Beijing, and they'll be all over the place. And then there'll be, like Tim's organization, ones that will go out and make deals abroad and have people abroad. So it's a very complex, wonderful world, and you are also wonderful to come and listen to me, and thank you very much.
So your partner for 16 years, your longest partnership, has been with Robin Richards. You've been a great team. That's clear in your results. You talk about in your book, and you've been a strong proponent of empowering women in society. How do you think we're doing on this front in Silicon Valley?
Well, you know, my old company, Sutter Hill, I said, when are you going to hire a female partner? They're curmudgeons there. They don't have any women, and I don't know why, because, you know, I learned in the UN, women hold up half the sky. That was the way it was put there. And I started something called Women in Development Division there at the UN, and we promoted them very aggressively. I think female entrepreneurs are as good as it gets, and it takes... there's a disadvantage they have because they're carrying a baby very often, and another one, and another one, and, you know, at some point you can't... But one of Tim's partners is amazing. She had two kids, came back to work about 2 weeks... You know, about 4 weeks after the first one, 3 weeks after the second one. And then she had twins, and she was back, honestly, she was back in 10 days. And that's the way, you know, Jennifer Fonstad is her name, and she and I are on a board together with Flurry, which is analytics for the, iPhone applications. And, analytics, and it's growing like a weed. And I watch her, and she's as tough as nails when it comes to being tough about, you know, don't give in to Apple, or don't, you know, she's tough. And yet she is so competent that she knows how to manage as a venture capitalist. I have a woman running my foundation, which I do want to mention, the Draper Richards Foundation, which starts up nonprofits. And I have it's all women. I have two women, Stanford MBAs, and they both had private sector experience. Jenny Schillingstein is extraordinary, and she... We backed Hotmail. Room to Read, and Kiva, and a new one that helps veterans. We backed about 30 of these deals, and we give them the money for 3 years, and then they're totally on their own. But we're again building the organization. Room to Read, as an example, we gave them their first $100,000. Today, they're $30 million. Budget 10 years later.
Do you think social entrepreneurship and funding that side by side with the traditional Silicon Valley startups is going to become part of more venture firms' palettes?
I hope so, because I think the techniques used in venture capital for profit can be used in the nonprofit. And by the way, the majority of my investments, when I look at my portfolio, are nonprofit, even though the idea was to make a profit. So I got well trained.
So a lot has changed in Silicon Valley over the last 50 years, and it sounds like a lot has stayed the same. We go through a lot of up and down times. In 2008, shortly after the market crash, Sequoia Capital called all their portfolio company CEOs together and presented them with a presentation that started with a tombstone that said, either tighten your belts or rest in peace. And they gave them very direct instructions to hunker down. What did you say to your CEOs in 2008, in 2001, and for that matter in 75 and 76 when we had 10% unemployment? How do you work with
the entrepreneur? One of the biggest mistakes that an entrepreneur makes is they don't cut back when the signals are all there that they better do it, because they think they're optimists or they wouldn't be doing this. Let's start there. Secondly, they have this feeling that they better it might be embarrassing to lay off some people, and you know it hurts their reputation. Well, their reputation really tanks when the whole company goes down. So it's very, very good to take action early. The other thing that often they don't do is when there's a recession and things are kind of in a tailspin, they don't take advantage of that and tighten up on the suppliers enough and take advantage of the fact that there are some really good people who are available that might not be available in good times. So there's a lot of things that the entrepreneur should do as he or she sees the future. And that's why you want a manager. You want somebody who has a peripheral vision and can see the what's going on around them, because otherwise they're just so focused, and that happens a lot. They don't do the kinds of things you're talking about, or the Valentine was. I started to say Valentine has the idea that the market is the most important thing. I have the idea that the leader is the most important thing. I didn't quite wrap that up in the earlier question.
So last Thursday, Goldman Sachs announced they were inundated for demand for the sale of Facebook shares at a $50 billion valuation, and they cut off taking orders, told people that had placed orders that they would get smaller proportions. That the raise was $1.5 billion. Google's trading at 7x revenue, so using this as a comp, that would imply that 2010 revenues of Facebook were over $7 billion, which is probably not likely. Kleiner Perkin led last month's $200 million round of funding for Twitter, bringing the Twitter valuation to $3.7 billion. What do you think about that?
I think it's very interesting because I'm also glad I wasn't asked to make a decision of whether that's a good investment or not, because I can't tell you. I'm of the old school that you know, you wanted to measure the earnings not X times revenue, but X times revenue, but X times earnings. However, there are these wonderful breakthroughs that you just can't measure because there's no marketing needed because they're viral and they somehow just take on a life of their own. And to say that Facebook is overvalued at $50 billion, I would never dare say that because the world keeps changing, and that's what's so exciting. That's why this is such a fun business. But I wouldn't want to try to predict whether that's going to be a high point or a low point in the price of that stock.
Bill, unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where I have to ask you the last question. You started with small funds, small amounts, and helped build great companies patiently and passionately. What's the most valuable advice you would give the potential fourth generation of the Draper investment dynasty?
Okay. Well, Adam, let me tell you, when you get into the venture capital business, make sure you've had some operating experience. Make sure you've done your homework before hooking up with either the other entrepreneur or the venture firm that you go to. Avoid joining your father. Try to be humble at all times. Try to think about each opportunity from the entrepreneur's standpoint and try to understand where they're coming from and what their reasoning is and be gracious to all of them because they are the future of this country and the entrepreneurs. I dedicated my book to the entrepreneurs of the world and I'm it was just a no-brainer for me because they're the ones that that make it all, make the world go round and make breakthroughs like the ones we've been talking about. So I'm just lucky to have been a part of the action.
Our thanks to Bill Draper, legendary venture capitalist, entrepreneur, and author of the new book, The Startup Game. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the internet. I'm Ann Winblad, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.